At 26 minutes after the hour, we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie, Anglican pastor in Virginia with his church in Fairfax, Virginia, lives in Ashburn, Virginia. He's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. And their website, I want to mention that to you. We'll talk about it more later, preservingbibletimes.org. Robbie, happy Thursday. How are things out east there? You're back into winter now? Because you've had some warm weather, haven't you?
Actually, it felt like spring out there yesterday and Monday. We worked on some bikes. It's been beautiful out here. Mm-hmm. Good to be with you here on the Broken Road, Jim and David. Thanks for having me on.
You've got a complicated agenda for me today. I'm still mentally trying to catch up here because you mentioned Matthew 12, and I mentioned that to the listeners, too, if they wanted to have their Bibles handy to chapter 12 of Matthew. And it's about the grain fields and picking heads of grain to eat, and it's about a confrontation with the Pharisees. There is a parallel chapter in Luke. It's Luke 6 that covers the same series of events, although covers it a little differently. Should that disturb us? I mean, I know there's important context in both these chapters, and that's really what I think we need to concentrate on here. What did the disciples do that irritated the Pharisees? This was all a setup, I know, but what was illegal about picking heads of grain on the Sabbath? Was it stealing grain? Was it doing work? What were the Pharisees griping about here?
It's the Sabbath day, and we're not supposed to harvest or work on the Sabbath day.
So
the
it was
issue
the work
here
aspect.
Is
okay.
The commandment 4, honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And I love Deuteronomy's account, this idea that the Israelites were slaves in Egypt, and they're no longer slaves. So God gives this fourth commandment to honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Fascinating enough, though, this commandment predates Exodus 20, and the Ten Commandment account, it actually goes back to creation when God creates all things in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. So God's a God of rest, unlike the pagan gods who never take a rest. And the reality that the Israelites were slaves in Egypt and could not rest. So slavery and religion go hand in hand. I think that religion can enslave us, just like slavery enslaves us, because religion says that you have to justify your own existence, prove your own worth, earn your keep, and you can't stop. And that's what slavery is. This is what the Israelites were doing in the wilderness, before the wilderness wandering in Egypt, when they were under Pharaoh and they couldn't stop working.
Well, both involve submission. That's true.
Yeah. Or a master.
Mm-hmm.
Who you may or may not be able to please, and the ability to give them what they want or to know what they want is out of your hands. So
you picked a sensitive topic here, and I don't want to interrupt your flow, your direction here, but the word slave is a very sensitive word. And I know when the King James Version was being put together in the early 17th century, they avoided the word slavery. It was in the original Greek manuscripts, but they chose instead the word servant, which is the word that's used in the King James Version. Now Bibles are going back to actually using the word slave in those. That's got to be a PR thing, doesn't it? Is it political, or is it contextual?
Who were they?
That's a good question, David.
Bible publishers. The newer translations
in what
used,
country?
Well, all around the world. The word slaves is okay in the Bible now. It was ruled out during the King James because of the political connotation, perhaps in England, in the kingdom. I'm not the English king, the British kingdom I'm talking about. Doug Greenwald makes quite a point out of this, that the original word in the Greek, that is the oldest manuscripts of the Gospels, use the word slave. But they avoided it in the King James Version, and now Bible scholars are saying, no, the actual word, and he used the Greek word. Robbie, can you?
Doulos.
Doulos, yes. Means slave, not servant. And the connotation is different between the two words. And I remember getting into this was on internetmonk.com. I mentioned that we are, in my post, that we were slaves to Christ, and people got angry at me. You can't. No, slave. No, we're free. Right. It's freedom in Christ. And I'm saying, no. I mean, if ever there was the perfect slave master, it would be Jesus Christ. and I would be a slave to Jesus. So, yeah, it, Paul, but it's the Paul connotation
says bond servant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
bond servant or doulos. Well, here's the issue. I mean, it depends on what context you're in that this the word slave might take on a different context. So when Paul talks about doulos or bondservant of Christ, slaves of Jesus, he's doing that in a Roman, Greco-Roman world with a Greco-Roman worldview. And Roman slavery is a lot different than antebellum slavery here in the United States. But when God speaks this to the Israelites, remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you from that place. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this. This is Deuteronomy 24:18. So this slavery goes all the way back to the Exodus, where God is freeing his people from slavery in Egypt. So the Sabbath day is intimately entwined, not only with the fact that God is a God of rest. On the seventh day, God rests from his labors. And again, Hebrews 4 talks about entering into God's rest. God is a God of rest, and we can enter into his rest. This goes through what Jesus talked about on the cross. I mean, Jesus' last words from the cross, it is finished. What is finished? The work is finished. So because Jesus' finished work on the cross, we are no longer slaves to religion trying to justify ourselves, because we can't. We never have been able to do it. And so we play God of our lives when we seek out religion as a way to justify ourselves or save ourselves. We're slaves. Again, Paul talks about this in Romans when he says we're slaves to sin. And so if we're slaves to sin, slavery, sin equals death, the wages of sin equals death, but also slavery takes away your freedom. And so we are slaves in our sin to sin, and we can't save ourselves from that predicament. We need a God of rest to give us rest, and this is exactly what Jesus was talking about in the previous chapter before we even get to Matthew 12, when he says, come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. A yoke is a rabbi's teaching. It's the burden that you would bear coming underneath your rabbi's teaching. So while the religious leaders of Jesus' day, the Pharisees, were contemplating what's the appropriate expression of obeying God and keeping the Sabbath day, they had added all kinds of rules, which eventually these oral traditions and written traditions would become the 613 laws of the Mishnah. I think that's around the second century, but much later it was written down, these oral traditions. But these rules that come from the Pentateuch to govern or to explain or to add commentary to the Ten Commandments. So what does it mean to keep the Sabbath day holy? And there's a whole section in the Mishnah. One of these rules is you can't spit, because if the spit comes out of your mouth and hits the ground, you're plowing. Now imagine if you can't plow, you certainly can't thresh grain. And really what the disciples are doing when they're going through the grain fields on the Sabbath day, they're plucking the heads of the grain from the stalk of the grain. They're rubbing the grain in between their fingers, removing the chaff, the wheat kernel from the chaff and the chaff from the wheat kernel. And then they're eating the wheat kernel, which we grind in a mill, like a hand mill, to make bread. And so they're basically feeding themselves. And right away, whose grain field is this? And why aren't they being accused of stealing?
Yeah, there's a good question, too.
Of theft.
And there's a reason for that. And the context there is Ruth and the laws around gleaning. And if a foreigner or a traveler, a sojourner, comes through your land, you're to leave anything that falls, you're not to pick it up. You're to leave it there for the hungry or the needy or the sojourner. You're not to harvest the corners of your grain fields for the same reason. for those who are in need can come and work for their food. They can come into your land and glean this grain for their own personal use. So the disciples aren't stealing this grain, no matter whose grain field this is. It's okay that they're actually plucking the heads off the grain. That's not the problem, according to the Pharisees. The problem, according to the Pharisees and the religious leaders, is that it's the Sabbath day, and they're threshing. They're technically threshing grain. They're working for their food instead of preparing in advance on the Sabbath day. Now, I would actually add, there's another law about how long you can travel. And if the disciples are traveling so long that they need to eat and that they're plucking the heads off the grain, they could actually be violating the Sabbath, according to these Pharisees, by how long they're traveling as well.
How many steps in a day was right. limited, yes. Mm-hmm.
But the issue that the Pharisees bring up is that your disciples are eating. They're plucking the heads of the grain. So all of this is in Matthew 12. Again, right after, I mean, the text ends in Matthew 11 with, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden." So that's important to see the text. I mean, these chapter breaks really mess up the flow. Hmm. In chapter 11, verse 28, Jesus says, "Come unto me, all you who are labor and heavy laden, and I'm going to give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." So that's how chapter 11 ends, before we even get into Jesus being the Lord of the Sabbath day and chapter 12.
Do we know where they were at that time? Were they typically, because typically they were up in the Galilee region, but and it may not be important to this, but if the Pharisees were there confronting Jesus at the time, they must have set this up.
Yeah, so he's near the synagogue, because this is in verse 9, we see that he went from there and entered in the synagogue. Again, I don't know.
Okay, well, the synagogue, though. You know, the synagogue could be anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. There are synagogues all over the region of Galilee. And so this is the Galilee of the Gentiles, but there are also, gosh, Capernaum, Bethsaida, Magdala. There's all kinds of synagogues all around. Many of them are still even being discovered today. So, you know, I don't know how long verse 9 is. He went from there, where they were picking the grain, mm-hmm. to the synagogue. Like, I just don't know where that is exactly.
Well, there are regions where wheat is grown primarily. It used to be around the Bethlehem area. That's how it got its name, House of Bread. So he could have been down there. But Chorazin is also a wheat-growing area.
Yeah, so yep. And that would be in the north around the Sea of Galilee. Mm-hmm. And this would fit well with mid-chapter 11, where Jesus is actually preaching against the north, and comparing Chorazin and Bethsaida to Tyre and Sidon.
His curse, yeah.
Yeah, so if you look in chapter 11, verse 20, he began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done. So he's speaking woes against Chorazin and Bethsaida, comparing them to Tyre and Sidon, and he talks about Capernaum as well. And then, of course, that could be alluding that he's close by.
Hmm. Interesting.
So in 12, back to 12 at hand, that the disciples are hungry. So they're traveling long enough through the grain fields on the Sabbath that the disciples are hungry, and they're plucking this grain, and they're eating it. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look at your disciples. They're doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath." And he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only the priest? Or have you not read in the law, on the Sabbath, the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and they're guiltless?" Now, that's my go-to verse. As an Anglican priest, I violate the Sabbath day every Sunday. And this this verse here, 12:5, tells me I'm guiltless. Now, I actually take Friday sundown to Saturday sundown as my Sabbath because I'm working on Sunday, where Christians are observing the Sabbath on the first day of the week with the Christian Sabbath, which is commemorating the resurrection of Jesus on Easter morning.
Well, again, that's very traditional because the Jewish day commenced at 6 p.m. So the Sabbath would have started at what we call 6 o'clock in the late afternoon, early evening on Friday and ended 6 p.m. Saturday. Yeah. So we know I think of Sunday as the Sabbath, but in this case it's different. Sunday was simply referred to as first day.
Mm-hmm.
In those days.
So we begin with rest. And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, that's very liturgical too, that we begin and end with rest. We begin our week with rest and we end our week with the beginning of the new week with rest. So it's kind of almost always bookended. And the Sabbath day is the only commandment, the only commanded day of feast that is not governed by natural phenomena. So in other words, this isn't following the agricultural cycle. This isn't following the moon. This is following God's commandment of seventh day, keep it holy. So I love what Jesus does here because Jesus quotes Samuel and King David eating the showbread. So this is loaded with context. Because in 1 Samuel 21, verses 1 through 6, David is fleeing from Saul, King Saul, and he goes into what was then the tabernacle, the tent, and there's a table with two stacks of bread, two stacks of six, 12 loaves, one for each tribe of Israel, and this is the showbread that only the priest could eat. And so you get this in Leviticus 24:9. It shall be for Aaron and his sons that they shall eat in a holy place, for it is for him a most holy portion out of the Lord's food offering, a perpetual due. So David's hungry. He's fleeing from King Saul. He's God's anointed to be the next king. Saul's trying to kill David. David takes refuge in the tabernacle. The priest feed him and his mighty men the showbread. They say, we don't have anything to eat for you. The only thing that's left is this showbread. And of course, they give it to David, and they give David and his mighty men Goliath's sword, and they flee from there. And then when Saul hears of it, he comes into the tabernacle, finds out the priest have not only given David the showbread, but he's given them Goliath's sword, and then Saul proceeds to kill and slaughter all the priests. It's a pretty crazy scene, and Jesus quotes it as justification of why his disciples are plucking the grain, and he's using it as his justification. Now, Jesus also says something fascinating in Matthew 12. He says something greater than the temple is here. So the Sabbath day, the holiest of days, the temple, the holiest of places, and here we've got Jesus' justification, the tabernacle preceding the temple is the tabernacle.
It was the temple of its day, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus is laying claim to the showbread, and he's basically putting himself in the position in this scenario as the high priest. He's the priest that's giving his men the bread on the Sabbath day. And what's going to happen to him? Like the priest who gave David and his men the showbread, he will be slaughtered by the religious leaders. He's driving out the money changers. He's purifying the temple. And this is beginning the events of Holy Week, which end up being Jesus' suffering and death. He's the atoning sacrifice. He's the great high priest. He's the temple of God. This is what he means when he says something greater than the temple is here. And this is why we need to read the Gospels in stereo, because if you look at John's Gospel expression of the cleansing of the temple, Jesus says, literally, he says, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. And he's talking about his body, but he's also destroying the idol of the temple for the religious leaders, because they had created an idol out of a place and they had missed God in the process. So they get angry and they say, we've spent 40 years building this temple and will you build it back in 3 days? And then it says plainly in the text that he's speaking about his body. But the illusion here of Jesus being the priest that gives his disciples bread, the show bread containing 12 loaves, one for every tribe of Israel, or as we would, you know, cross-reference or foreshadow to the disciples, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 disciples, and he has them with him plucking the grain, and clearly he's putting himself in the position of the priest who will be slaughtered for giving his followers this bread.
There are a series of confrontations here between Jesus and the Pharisees. They were after him. This must have been toward the end of his 3.5-year ministry, when he was gaining so much steam, such a following among the common folk, that they began to feel threatened. And because they'd been investigating, sending spies from the beginning. And here there's a group with them. It's odd that they would follow the disciples through a field and then confront them. I mean, it's like they're a posse, you know?
Right. It's like having Big Brother over your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
You've got these people following you around and nitpicking everything you do. And so, you know, the punctuation of the breaking the Sabbath day and the plucking the heads of the grain is verse 8. For the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus says, I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. And this is important because Jesus says elsewhere, remember, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And that's right, because God creates in the first 6 days, including creating man. And then he rested on the seventh day. So Sabbath is a gift, but it also puts us in the position that we're proclaiming when we observe it, that we're not God. Every time we don't work on the Sabbath day, we're saying, God, you're God, I'm not. And if I stop, the world will continue. Because as Jesus said, my Father is always working and I too am working up until this day. Like, God is holding the universe in control. I don't need to be the one trying to make things happen. So God is a God of rest. God is the Lord of Sabbath. The Sabbath is a gift for man. It's not a burden for man to bear. This is, again, tying in 11, 28, and 29, where Jesus says, take my yoke upon you. Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. That's important. And then immediately they're at the synagogue, went from there to the synagogue, and there was a man with a withered hand. And now, again, this is an illustration of how the things just ended in verse 8. If the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath, and if God desires mercy and not sacrifice, what do you do about the need on the Sabbath? What do you do with this man with a withered hand on the Sabbath day? Well, Jesus heals him as an object lesson. And he doesn't just heal him. We know from Luke's gospel in Luke chapter 6 that it's the man's right hand. It's not just any hand. It's he's got a withered right hand. So when Jesus heals this man's withered right hand, he doesn't just heal his hand. He gives him his life back. He doesn't just heal his hand. He allows him to be able to go back into the temple. He doesn't just heal his hand. He enables him to be pure. He doesn't just heal his hand. He restores him to society.
Well, we need to distinguish between left and right for folks here.
That's
the
right.
Left hand was for personal hygiene. Okay?
Yeah.
And day before, toilet paper.
Yep.
So you were forbidden from eating, for example, with your left hand. In fact, around a triclinium table, you would lie on your left side so you couldn't use your left hand on the table to dip bread into whatever you were eating. So it was a really sensitive thing in that culture. So it's significant that in Luke, he mentioned, I mean, who cares what hand it is? Well, right hand to them in that context of the time would have meant this was total restoration. He was now welcome back in society as a functioning member of the culture. So it was a big deal. And so that's an important distinction. Now, in Matthew, they don't mention which hand. But in Luke, he thought it was important to say. There's a reason he said that.
So Luke's a physician. Again, this is why I encourage folks to read their read the Gospels in 4D, four dimensions, or 4G in this case, four Gospels. Read them all. If our passage has a parallel passage, read all of the accounts, and here's an example of why. If Luke is a physician and he understands which hand it is and why that's important and chooses to highlight it, well, when we go back to look at what Jesus is actually doing by healing this man, wow, if God desires mercy and not sacrifice, God's being merciful to this man religiously. He's being merciful to this man societally. He's being mercifully to this man economically. He's being merciful to this man in giving his life back. He's able to work for his family and to be able to sustain his family. He's able to function in society without being impure or making other people impure. God's removing his fear and the fear of everybody else around him that he is unclean, and he's restoring him back to the temple.
There's a key word. First the healing, then the restoration. That's something Jesus did time and time again. So you need to look for the clues in those gospel passages where he heals and figure out where the restoration comes in. And and another aspect of this, which I think relates to why the Pharisees were angry and they muttered to themselves afterwards, they had hoped to entrap, they knew Jesus would, they arranged for the guy to be there. Right. And they knew Jesus would heal him. But Jesus simply said, hold out your hand, and the hand was restored. Jesus did no work on the Sabbath. And it frustrated the Pharisees no end.
Yeah. So that's verse 11, by the way, in Luke's gospel, Luke 6:11. They were filled with fury. I love that description. And discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. And again, this is the priest on the Sabbath putting himself in a position to be merciful and to provide for his disciples and to be killed for it.
Important passages and a whole lot of information packed in there. I suppose we could spend another week on this, Robbie, but thanks so much for what you bring us. We look forward to Thursdays with Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Again, he's the Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. I noticed a newsletter went out this last week, too. That happens once, twice, sometimes even three times a month. Robbie puts out the Between the Lines newsletter. You can sign up for it at preservingbibletimes.org. It's free. You look forward to getting it in your email every month, and you'll learn a whole bunch like we learn with Robbie every Thursday. Rob, have a terrific week. See you next
Thanks
week.
For having me on The Broken Road. Always a pleasure, Jim and David. And we're celebrating 100 episodes in a year. We've put out 100 podcast episodes, part of what we're doing right here. So hope your listeners will join us on the Preserving Bible Times podcast as well. Have a great week, gentlemen, and thanks so much again for having me on.